little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I'm excited about this conversation. Been looking forward to it for quite a while. We've got a great guest all connected up. I'll introduce our guest in just a moment, but Julia, why don't you give a little preview about the topics that we'll be covering?
I'm also very excited about these topics, and I'm not sure if we have enough time to go through all of them today, but in this episode, we will be discussing the science of human consciousness, exploring how human consciousness can be thought of as a controlled hallucination, and examining the relationship of the brain as a prediction machine to critical thinking and human belief formation.
And our guest for this episode is Anil Seth, professor of cognitive computational neuroscience at the University of Sussex, where he is also the director of the Sussex Center for Consciousness Science. Professor Seth co-directs the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research Program on Brain, Mind, and Consciousness, and he's editor-in-chief of the open access journal Neuroscience of Consciousness. And with a BA in natural sciences, an MS degree in knowledge-based sciences, PhD in computer science and artificial intelligence from the University of Sussex, and a postdoc and associate fellowship at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego, California, Dr. Seth has authored close to 200 journal publications, is a regular contributor to New Scientist, The Guardian, and BBC, and in 2021, shared his knowledge with the world through his publication of the international bestseller, Being You, A New Science of Consciousness. Professor Seth, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you very much, Bob and Julia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. As Bob had mentioned in the intro, that the full title of your book is Being You, A New Science of Consciousness. And of course, here on Thinking Clearly, we like to define our terms so we all know what we're talking about. Although I imagine defining consciousness could probably take this whole episode and maybe a little bit more. For our purposes here, could you maybe give us a brief definition of how you define consciousness and how we think about consciousness? And I'm also curious what drew you to focus your time and intellect on this topic.
Thank you. Definitely a good idea to start off with a little bit of definition of terms, but not getting sucked into it, because consciousness is it's a word we're all familiar with. People use it in different ways. I think it can be defined pretty simply, at least for present purposes. Consciousness is what goes away when you go under general anesthesia, and it's what comes back when you come round again. In general anesthesia, it's very different from sleep. You know, under sleep, you lose track of what's going on, and you might be unconscious for a while, but you're always aware that some time has passed. Under general anesthesia, you're gone. There's oblivion. There's nothing subjectively happening at all. You're turned into an object and then back again into a person. A slightly more formal definition comes from the philosopher Thomas Nagel, who said in a very famous paper now, he said, for a conscious organism, there is something it is like to be that organism. And I think what he's getting at here is that for a conscious system, a conscious organism, it feels like something to be that system. It feels like something to be me. It feels like something to be you. But it doesn't feel like anything to be a table or a chair or I would say an iPhone or a laptop computer. These things are objects. They can be complex objects, but there's no experiencing going on. That's really the heart of consciousness. It's any kind of experience whatsoever. There's something happening subjectively, then there is consciousness. The second part of your question, why has this been such an appealing subject? Well, I think actually a lot of people are interested in consciousness from an early age. It has many aspects. It's not only the difference between being awake and aware and being under general anesthesia. When we are conscious, we're conscious of many different things in many different ways. And a key aspect of consciousness is the self. And we are all interested in ourselves and in each other. And certainly when I was young, I was curious about questions like, do I have free will? Where was I before I was born? Where will I go when I die? And these questions matured into an interest into, you know, put in a slightly different way. We know that our brains are these complex biological systems, yet somehow they don't just do stuff. There's also experience happening. Now, when my brain is in a particular state, then I have a conscious experience. I open my eyes and my brain doesn't just process information. I see colors and shapes. I experience the warmth of a sunset and the taste of a nice dinner. And that has been a mystery for thousands of years. How do you get from a physical system, however complex it might be, to a conscious experience? How are they related? I feel very lucky that in my career, this question has become, once again, a central question within neuroscience and related subjects and philosophy as well. And I've been lucky to be able to forge a career thinking about it, studying it.
Isn't it funny how something that we all experience and all most of us question at some point is this thing that seems to be such a mystery? So I've heard about this, like the easy problem of consciousness and the hard problem. What's the difference between the easy problem of consciousness and the hard problem of consciousness? Also, if you have a chance to describe what you refer to as maybe the real problem of consciousness.
Yeah, definitely. I think we'll get onto that. The difference between the easy and the hard problems was a distinction made by the philosopher David Chalmers. And it's been very, very influential, and for good reason, because consciousness seems very mysterious. A conscious experience, the redness of red, the sharpness of a pain. I mean, that doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that a physical system, a brain or a computer or whatever, could easily have. You know, physical systems do things. They're atoms bumping into each other. How could any of that amount to a conscious experience? That's the hard problem. He puts it like this. He says, we know that consciousness is intimately related to the brain, but how and why is still unexplained. It seems objectively unreasonable that the brain should give rise to consciousness, and yet it does. How does that happen? That's the hard problem. And he contrasts it with the easy problem, which is easy only conceptually. So the easy problem, or the easy problems, for there are many, are the problems of understanding how the brain works as a physical system, how it transforms inputs into outputs, how it implements functions. You can treat the brain like that. You can think of it as a very complex machine. And that's what most of neuroscience does. It tries to figure out how brains do what they do, how they generate behavior, how they control our actions and so on, and how they even form perceptions and how they might influence our ability to pay attention to things. And Chalmers' point is that in principle, you could address all of these questions and still be completely in the dark about how and why any of this should have anything to do with consciousness. Consciousness seems harder in a different way, not just hard science, but hard in the sense of we don't even know what it would be like to come up with an answer about how neurons or other brain cells generate or are identical to consciousness. That distinction has been very influential because I think it resonates with experience of thinking about these things. Consciousness seems something that would be difficult for merely material physical systems to have. It seems like there's a hard problem. Now, I prefer to think in terms of this real problem of consciousness. This is in practice what a lot of people do, not just me. But it's a way, I think, of dissolving this dichotomy, because I think if you think about consciousness in terms of such a hard and sharp distinction, that affects what you do. I mean, this is, I think, a good point to start thinking about the value of critical thinking here, because the way you set up the problem will determine the kinds of answers that you look for. And if you treat consciousness as one big scary mystery, how does matter become conscious mind? The temptation is to look for one eureka moment of a solution, some magic or non-magic, because we're looking for things that are, you know, explicable, but something really dramatic that will cross that explanatory gap. Now, we might find that, but we might not. And so another way to address the problem is to realize that consciousness is not one big scary mystery. It has many aspects. There's conscious perception of the world around us. There's conscious perception or experience of being a self within that world. There are different conscious levels, from sleep and anesthesia, states of meditation, and so on. And there are many things we can explain about consciousness without addressing that hard problem head on. Like, why are visual experiences the way they are, not some other way? Why emotional experiences the way they are. And my hope and strategy is that by explaining these distinct aspects of consciousness in terms of things happening in the brain and the body, the sense of mystery surrounding the hard problem will begin to lessen and perhaps eventually fade away entirely. And this has happened before in the study of life. At one time, people thought life could not be explained in terms of physics and chemistry. There was a hard problem of life, and the philosophy of vitalism was predicated on the assumption that life could not be explained in terms of science as it was. So there was this idea we needed an élan vital, a spark of life. Now, of course, nobody found this because it doesn't exist and there's no need for it. Once biologists got on with the job of explaining the properties of living systems, metabolism and reproduction, then this sense of mystery about life faded away. And so that's the approach, the motivation for the real problem of consciousness. Even if it doesn't get all the way there, it's going to get somewhere. It is already getting somewhere. And as we do, I think the questions we ask about consciousness will also change. It's not just you have a question and that question always has to stay the same until you find the answer. I think a good integration of science and philosophy are when questions and answers evolve together.
I love that. I also love the way that you not only talk about the new science of consciousness, you give other theories and other ideas about consciousness. For example, you talk about Giulio Tonini's integrated information theory. It's a good presentation. I've read some about that theory, but the way you lay it out in the book answered some questions for me anyway about that theory. So in addition to framing what you mean by the word consciousness, which we just did, let's lay out some of the other essential foundation here at the start. So give our listeners a little primer on predictive processing, minimizing predictive error, and what you called controlled hallucination.
Right. Yes. These are all really central topics and concepts in the book, and also very central to the work that I've been doing in the lab and for the book and still now. The idea here is to go after the problem of consciousness a bit indirectly by trying to understand how the brain forms perceptions of the world and the body. And sometimes these perceptions can be conscious. And we have an experience. We open our eyes and we experience a scene before us. And sometimes they can be unconscious. And we know from many experiments that some sensory input to the brain doesn't change our conscious experience at all, but it can still affect our behavior. You know, we have these unconscious ways of responding to things. So there's a question here about how can we understand, how can we explain how the brain is able to generate these perceptual experiences of the world? And it may seem that there's nothing to explain here at all. I mean, we just open our eyes and there's a world as if it's just pouring itself transparently into our minds. But things are not that simple. Indeed, they cannot be that simple. There's an indirect relationship between what's out there in the world, what's happening in our experience, and indeed, even between what's happening in our bodies and what's happening in experience. The brain, of course, is central to this, but all the brain has access to are electrical signals, sensory signals, which are only indirectly related to what's out there in the world and what's in the body. And so the idea of predictive processing is that the brain, in to a first approximation, in trying to figure out what's going on in the world, is basically doing something that in philosophy and logic we call Bayesian inference. It's trying to figure out, make a best guess about the causes of its sensory signals, given its prior expectations about the way the world is and the way the body is. It's making a best guess. In logic, this would be abductive reasoning. Now, it's not deduction where one thing follows from another, nor is it induction where you see, you know, patterns repeat and you assume they're going to continue. Abductive reasoning is something that happens under uncertainty. It is basically, given some input and given some prior expectation, what's the most likely thing going on? Now, that mathematically is a very hard problem to solve, but there are approximations, there are tricks, and it looks like evolution has hit on a particular trick, which is predictive processing. And in this proposed mechanism, it's really a hypothesis about how the brain works. The brain is always making predictions in a kind of inside-out, top-down direction about what's going on in the world or the body. And it uses sensory signals to update these predictions, to calibrate them, to keep them tied to the world. In this process, if the brain then continually updates these predictions in light of the sensory signals, and it will perform something like this Bayesian abductive reasoning. It will settle on a best guess of what's out there or what's in here. This is the second concept. This is prediction error minimization. So the idea here is the brain is doing one very simple thing, broadly speaking, which is updating its predictions or making actions to minimize the sensory prediction errors. By doing this, the top-down predictions will settle on an optimal best guess about what's going on. And this is where the third term comes in, controlled hallucination. Conceptually, the claim here, at least my way of interpreting this, because this theory itself is not mine, it's been around for a long time. The direction I take is to say, what we experience is not a readout of the sensory input. It's the contents of the inside-out, top-down predictions that are always calibrated, shaped by the sensory input, but it's not a readout of the sensory input. And that's why I call it controlled hallucination, which, by the way, is a term also not mine. I borrowed it from others who came before. And I like the term, though. It's not perfect. No linguistic metaphor is perfect. But for me, it emphasizes that our experience of the world and the body comes from within. You know, it's not a direct reflection of how things actually are. It's something the brain is perpetually involved in actively constructing. But it's not completely arbitrary and unrelated to things as they are. And so it's a controlled hallucination. It's geared by evolution so that we experience the world in a way that is useful for us. We don't see things as they are or hear things as they are. We experience things as evolution has decided it is useful for us to do so. The thing that I keep coming back to about this is it is very challenging for our intuitions. I mean, it's very easy to say these words, but it seems to us as though we experience the world in all its objective glory, as if the color of the sky really is blue, or as if the table out there has all the properties that it seems to have without my mind or brain having anything to do with it. That's the intuition that the new, you know, these sciences of perception are challenging. Not that nothing exists, of course stuff exists, but the way we experience it, that's always a construction. Philosophically, this goes back as far as you like, but a good place to land is Immanuel Kant. And he had this idea that we will never have direct access to the world as it is, the noumenon. Well, things will only ever be an interpretation. And in my mind, pretty much we can see this way of thinking about the brain and perception as footnotes to Kant.
Way back when I took my psychology classes, I learned that the brain builds a sort of a cognitive map of the world by a bottom-up process of our senses detecting features of the world. That's a bottom-up process. But what you're talking about, there's a top-down process coming from that map of the world, our understanding of how the world works, and that there's a sort of a competing process there. That the top-down process really is much more a part of the picture than we used to think. Is that accurate?
Yes, mostly, I think so. I wouldn't call it a map. I mean, in the brain, when we talk about maps, it's often slightly means slightly different things. One of the assumptions, or if you like, implications of this way of thinking is that the brain can be described as having some kind of generative model. You know? And this in the brain is an internal model of what's going on in the world. And it's using that to generate predictions about what's happening in the world now at a particular instant. And these generative models that we suppose are in the brain, well, you know, they can arise from evolution, from development, and they can be tuned in daily experience as well. Now, when I was an undergraduate too, and I was reading neuroscience textbooks, it was still all or predominantly this kind of bottom-up, outside in descriptions of information coming into the brain and being read out in different stages, and top down processes doing a bit, but not a lot. Now that is the description that is flipping here. It's not that they're competing. I think they are both essential. They're collaborating really. You know, you have the predictions flowing in this inside out direction and prediction errors in a bottom up outside in direction. And you need both for the brain to settle on a best guess about what's going on. That process is continually evolving, and whatever the best guess is at the current time, the hypothesis is, well, that's what we experience.
What does it take for that top-down process, which is convinced the world what they previously believed it was, what has to happen for it to change that model of the world by the sensory information coming in?
Well, there are, I think, at least two ways that we can change in this regard. I mean, it clearly works, right? We don't just have one static perception. Our experience is changing all the time. The brain will always make a different inference when the data changes. So perception is perfectly able to change on the fly. And the balance between the top-down predictions and the bottom-up prediction errors. Now, that's very interesting. How is that balance finessed by the brain? If it gets this balance wrong in some way, then our perceptual experience might be dominated too much by the top-down predictions. And maybe that is what happens in cases we classically call hallucination, where people experience things that other people don't. And so the brain is actively managing this balance so as to finesse how bottom-up prediction errors update top-down predictions. Another aspect of this change is at a slightly different time scale. So we can learn to see things differently as well. So we have these, where did the predictions come from? They come from this model the brain has about the causal structure of the world and the body. And over a slower time scale, that causal model can change. A good example here is if we start drinking wine, having never drunk wine before, and everything tastes the same to start with, but then we learn to tell the difference. And the sensory signals might be the same from two different wines, but now we have a richer generative model that's able to form different predictions. And so we will have different experiences. Our causal model of the world has changed. It's developed, it's branched a little bit, and our space of possible experiences becomes broader.
Is it possible to design experiments to examine that balance?
Absolutely. So some of the things that we've been doing in our lab do exactly this. And you can do it in many different ways. You can put people in brain imaging machines, and you can actually map out the signals that are flowing in these different directions and see what's happening. We don't do so much of that because there are questions you can ask just by so-called behavioral experiments that don't require fancy brain imaging methods. Basically, you can give people different expectations about what's going on, and then you can play around with how these expectations match the data. And you can also play around with what they pay attention to. You know, if you ask them to pay attention to something, what you're doing is shifting that balance more towards the sensory prediction errors than the top-down predictions. To give you an example of a number that might be given, is we showed people images which could either be a house or a face, but they were very difficult to see. We used some experimental manipulation so you couldn't see them to start with, but then they would become visible. But we also cued people about what the image might be. And sometimes the cue, which was a word, was valid, and sometimes it was invalid. And what we found was that when the cue was valid, people saw the image more quickly and more accurately than when it was not valid. And that's exactly what you'd expect to happen if conscious perception depended on this kind of match between what the brain predicts and what the sensory information are consistent. There's a cliche in English, right, where you say, I'll believe it when I see it. And it's almost the other way around in these experiments, that I'll see something when my brain believes that's what's going on.
I'm wondering whether there has been any attempts to identify personality types where there's more top-down influence than bottom-up.
That's a very interesting question. And there has been. And one of the arenas where this is happening is in different kinds of, well, let's say people who are more prone to have hallucinations, whether this is because they have a history of psychosis or they score highly on personality scales or psychological trait scales of psychosis proneness or hallucination proneness. That can be understood through this imbalance of top-down and bottom-up processing. Now, there are actually many ways it could cash out. Maybe your top-down predictions are too strong, or paradoxically, it could in fact be the other way around, that your sensory information is too strong, so they update your predictions more than it otherwise would. So then you start seeing things that other people don't. On the flip side, there are conditions like autism. Often people with autism have extraordinary sensory sensitivity. So their perceptual environment can seem very overwhelming. And so that might also speak to an imbalance where the bottom-up sensory information is not being attenuated enough. More broadly, though, one implication of this way of thinking is that we all experience the world differently, whether we think of ourselves on a scale or a spectrum of one sort or another. Now, we will all experience things differently, even for the same shared objective reality. There was a famous photograph a few years ago of this photo of a dress that was either blue and black or white and gold. And half the world saw it one way and half saw it another way. What was fascinating about that was not that people saw things differently, though that was interesting, but the conviction they had that they were right and that everybody else was wrong, or everybody on the other side was wrong. I think there's a real lesson there, that there can be other ways of experiencing things, like literally experiencing things differently for the same image. And I think that should give us a bit of humility about ways of seeing and then indeed our ways of thinking. And if it's possible for two people to see this photo diametrically opposite, then it should be no surprise that we can live in ostensibly a shared world and come to very different views about it. One of the studies we're doing now is this quite ambitious experiment where we've got about 40,000 people each doing an hour or more of psychological experiments to try and explore this space of perceptual diversity, because it doesn't have to be as dramatic as this dress, which was the difference in experience is very dramatic. But the three of us, you know, we may just be experiencing time differently, or we may be experiencing color differently, and we won't know because our experiences are private and subjective, and it seems to us that we see things as they really are. But I do think we've got this inner diversity that complements, you know, the external diversity that's actually quite easy to see. Mapping this out is, for me, it's really an exciting project, but I think it's also this one that has almost a guerrilla social agenda here, to have people recognize that, you know, we live in perceptual echo chambers to some extent, as well as living in social media echo chambers.
I think to change gears just a little bit, do you see consciousness as an emergent phenomenon? And maybe also, you know, if you could help our listeners understand the idea of emergence and why you do or don't use that to explain consciousness.
Definitely a gear change, but it's a gear change I quite like. I'm very interested in this concept. It's got a bit of a checkered history in the sense that consciousness has this air of mystery. You know, how could it ever be explained? And an emergence is often this magic explanation where you just say something emerges from something else and it gives you a carte blanche to just leave it at that. And that's not very useful. So in one reading of the term emergence, you would say something like consciousness just emerges from the activity of neurons, which themselves are not conscious. But, you know, that's not an explanation. That's just a placeholder for an explanation. So there's a suspicion to this use of the word emergence because it sounds a bit spooky, like somehow you just magically get this extra property. But that's not the only way to think of emergence. Emergence is, for me, best thought of as a situation where you have a whole that is in some quantifiable way more than the sum of the parts. A good example for me is something like a flock of birds. So I'm in Brighton in the south coast of England, and during the winter, there's always a flock of starlings that roost on the ruins of an old pier. And this flock of thousands of birds, individual birds, seems to have an autonomy of its own, a behavior of its own. It seems to be an entity unto itself, more than the sum of the individual birds that make it up. But of course, there's no mystery here. There is nothing other than the birds in the flock. But nonetheless, to us, there's a big difference between this flock wheeling around in the sky and birds flying all over the place randomly or in some kind of rigid formation. So I think that's a useful example because it allows us to then say, okay, how do we measure the flockiness of a bunch of birds flying around. And there are ways to do this. And this is what me and my colleagues work on. How do we measure the flockiness in a way that we, you know, don't rely on our just visual intuitions? We can put some data in and ask, how flocky is that data? And then we can generalize that to things where it doesn't leap out. So in the brain, we have 86 billion neurons, but we have a one conscious experience at a time. So in a trivial sense, there is something emergence-like happening here. Consciousness is probably not, and say probably because we don't know, but it's probably not associated with any single neuron. But out of the collective activity of neurons, a conscious experience is there somehow. Now, emergence is not the explanation of that, but we can use emergence as a mathematical tool to understand how these two levels of description relate to each other. For instance, when you wake up from general anesthesia, do neurons in the brain start to behave in a flocky type way in some, you know, higher dimensional space? These concepts, they allow us to move beyond things like just looking for brute correlations between activity in this part of the brain and something happening in consciousness. Now, we need more sophisticated bridges that have traction both at the level of mechanism, you know, so what the neurons do, how can we describe the behavior of collections of neurons, and at the level of our experience, where we have this unified experience, a single experience at a time. So emergence for me is a very useful concept for that, but not when applied in a spooky way.
Listeners, if you want to be adventurous and see how mathematics relates to that aspect of consciousness, you could check out a paper in Physical Review that Anil Seth and Lionel Barnett did. I love mathematics, but it's going to take me a while to get through that. But if you want to know how mathematics contributes, you can download that paper. It's called Dynamical Independence: Discovering Emergent Macroscopic Processes in Complex Dynamical Systems.
Well, courage to everybody. I mean, that's a tricky paper. I must admit, my colleague I've worked with for over 10 years is a much better mathematician than I am. And we worked together on this. And you know, I was involved in what we were trying to do. And he was developing the mathematical framework for it. I have to say, it's not simple, but it is satisfying when you get there. One point maybe to add here is that, why do the mathematics? Well, they don't merely allow us to make measurements, but it turns out there are many ways of thinking about emergence. You know, we have this example of a flock of birds, but you know, there are other examples that could be given. And even within the flock of bird examples, there turn out to be at least a few different ways of coming up with a mathematical measure. And that for me is very useful because in this sense, the maths gives us new thoughts. You know, it's a bit like that example of the wine. You know, you learn the difference between different kinds of wine. Here, we're learning the difference between different kinds of emergence because the language of mathematics can allow us to separate them and define them, and then the space gets richer.
We've alluded to critical thinking a couple times, and I think our listeners in some of the conversations so far have put it together with why we've invited you on in terms of the relevance of what you've been doing research on, the relevance that that has for critical thinking. So I'm going to ask you that question, and I anticipated that you would make the statement, well, it depends on how you define critical thinking. So I'm going to build that right into the question here and review our definition of critical thinking. Our working definition views that as a mode of thinking that uses a process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. And then to that kind of formal working definition, we add a longer list, a description, a number of attitudes, and or you might call them mindsets that accompany how we view critical thinking, like an awareness and an attempt to compensate for the vulnerabilities that we all have in our thought processes, including cognitive biases, a willingness to be a lifelong learner, genuine curiosity, and a couple of others. So my question is, using that definition of critical thinking, what is the relationship of critical thinking to consciousness, and is consciousness necessary to be a critical thinker?
Well, I think the answer is in the second part of the question. So I think there's a very simple and clear relationship, which a lot of what researchers do in my field is try to understand the difference between conscious and unconscious processes in the brain and the mind. You know, what can be done unconsciously, what requires consciousness, and perhaps sometimes the other way around. And it strikes me that the way you define critical thinking here is very intimately tied up with consciousness. It's very difficult to engage in that kind of cognitive process unconsciously. I'm reminded of the psychologist Daniel Kahneman, who died quite recently, and his distinction between system one and system two ways of thinking. System one is this relatively automatic, fast, can be very efficient way of thinking, reacting to a situation. And system two is this slower, more reflective, more effortful, perhaps more critical way of thinking. And this distinction has been very influential, and sometimes associated with the distinction between unconscious and conscious processing. You know, I know a number of colleagues and people who've put it this way. I don't think that's quite right. You know, when we do things quickly and automatically, it's not that we're always unconscious of these things. Like, you know, if I'm driving to work on along a route that I've driven thousands of times over the nearly 20 years I've been at this university, then it's fairly automatic. You know, I have to do too much system two critical reflection about where I'm going, but I'm certainly not unconscious. You know, I'm experiencing, you know, the visual world around me, the traffic, and my mind might be drifting, thinking about other things, but I'm definitely not unconscious. So it's a little more complex than that. And my suspicion is that effective critical thinking probably requires both aspects. We require some sort of maybe automatic biases that come from the fast, learnt and relatively automatic cognitive reflexes, if you like. And then that has to interact with this more reflective aspects of thought. And when one of these aspects is lacking, then we go wrong. Obviously, if we lack the ability to reflect and take our time, then very hard for us to satisfy the definition of critical thinking that you have it. But the other way around, I think it's harder to show, but it is probably true too. And a good line of evidence for this, another classic book that inspired me a lot was Antonio Damasio's book, Descartes' Error, from the early 1990s. And he gave a number of examples about how our ability to reason effectively depended on emotion. Now, you couldn't sort of strip away the purely rational part of the mind and rely on that in the way that the Enlightenment philosopher Descartes was really sort of emphasizing, the cognitive, rational, conscious mind. No, we need emotional responses to, in practice, make good decisions. Now, this may not be quite critical thinking, but in practice, without emotional biases, intuitions that guide us, I think then we certainly won't be able to think effectively, even if effective thinking is not quite the same thing as critical thinking.
If you had to answer yes or no, is consciousness required for critical thinking?
Yes, I think so. I could have just said yes, probably. By the way, I did like the other aspects you put in about the other aspects of the mindset, and I think that's really important because there's not going to be one hard and fast rule, right? I mean, I like the list you gave, and I was thinking about what I would put in that list, and I think I would add to it only a couple of things. Like you say, awareness of the vulnerabilities. And I think this is really important. You know, psychological work has told us a lot about our cognitive biases, you know, our inability to reason well over long stretches of time or long distances in space. You know, we have all these kinds of cognitive effects. Again, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky wrote about these things beautifully. And I also think personally, it's hugely important to retain humility about the reach of our reason. You know, what can we explain and what can't we explain? and to radically acknowledge the things we don't know, to be willingly, well, not willingly ignorant, but recognize our areas of ignorance rather than try and paper over them with bad reasoning.
Mm-hmm. Now, one follow-up question here. Do you think that artificial intelligence will ever be able to emulate human critical thinking?
I think AI can be a very useful tool to complement human critical thinking. I am agnostic about whether it can ever fully emulate human critical thinking, partly because it's not entirely clear to me that humans are very good at critical thinking all the time. I mean, we fall short of these criteria, and maybe we do so in a way that's necessary. And it depends what kind of AI we're talking about. You know, early AI was really based on logic. And so it was all about representing the world in terms of symbols and then applying logical reasoning to those symbols to figure stuff out. And so in that sense, you could say that those sorts of AI systems, well, they're engaging in a form of critical thinking, but it's a very narrow, restricted form, and it turned out to be not all that useful. And now we have systems like language models, in particular, I think, are really the forefront of people's minds. And we can ask them things, and they can give linguistic responses which seem to show some kind of thinking or reasoning. But here, I think we're on very thin ice. One of our cognitive biases is the bias to project qualities into things, human-like qualities into things that don't have them, on the basis of superficial similarities. And I think we far too readily project the qualities of understanding into language models when they don't actually understand things. Under the hood, they're just predicting the next most likely word or bit of a word based on having been trained on everything that was ever written. Turns out when you do that and you use clever algorithms like transformers and so on, you get really interesting stuff. I think everyone I know of has been surprised by the kinds of things that language models can generate. But we shouldn't get too excited. Their ability to be surprising does not warrant the conclusion that they actually understand things in the ways that human beings do. So they can be very, very useful, but we shouldn't confuse them with ourselves.
Where I was going with this is if we could construct an argument that critical thinking requires consciousness. That would be one premise. Second premise would be we want artificial intelligence to give us information critically, be a critical thinker. Therefore, artificial intelligence would require consciousness. We could construct that argument, and that's a big issue with artificial intelligence.
Okay, so I want to knock that argument straight out of the park.
Oh, please do.
Partly because I don't like the conclusion. So it is motivated reasoning. I confess to that. But I think it depends on a couple of critical nuances, a way of putting it. The idea that critical thinking requires consciousness, I was interpreting in the human case. I think for humans to think critically, we need to be conscious. I think that's a case that can be made. I do not think it's necessarily true in general. It might be true by definition. If you say thinking is a conscious process by definition, then it's true in general. But if you allow that it might not be, then it could well be that critical thinking in other non-human or non-biological systems might not require consciousness. You know, after all, planes don't flap their wings. There are other ways of doing things. So that's one possibility. But I also push back a little bit about what we want here. You know, do we want AI to replace us as critical thinkers? One of my mentors, another person who sadly died recently, Daniel Dennett, had this very nice way of thinking about AI. He said, and he'd been saying it for a long time, we should treat AI as tools rather than colleagues and always remember the difference. Again, if we project our minds too far and assume that these systems, they actually instantiate some of the human qualities we have, I think we go horribly astray. I think AI can be useful for complementing critical thinking, but I'm not sure we'd want to aspire for it to be critical thinking systems themselves. I mean, maybe yes, maybe no. And even if so, that doesn't require consciousness. And there are very many reasons why we should not aspire to build consciousness into AI? You know, many moral and ethical reasons, because of course they would have moral and ethical status, and we might create systems that had the potential to suffer in ways we wouldn't even recognize, and that could be an ethical catastrophe.
I just want to go on public record for saying I, for one, welcome our future AI overlords. So that's on the public record, just in case. It's really interesting, actually, what you brought up as tools. Something we've talked about, Bob and I have talked about quite a bit on this show, is a lot of these things that we talk about are in fact tools, and it's a matter of how we leverage them and how we apply them to the problems we're trying to solve. So I think that's a really insightful way of approaching future AI overlords, if you will. Returning back to your book, earlier in your book, you explained that with regard to consciousness, you tend toward a functionally agnostic flavor of physicalism. I think we kind of got a little bit of a philosophic taste of this earlier. Without getting too lost in the weeds of deep philosophical discussions, which Bob and I usually reserve for after this show, one-on-one, but can you help us unpack that statement a little bit for us? What tend towards a functionally agnostic flavor of physicalism means to you?
Yeah, it's amazing you can get away with a phrase like that in a book intended for a general audience. So I promise any potential readers it's not all like that. What do I mean? I mean, this was part of the setting up the approach early on in the book and setting up, explaining my own way of thinking about consciousness. There are many options you can take, choices on the menu for how you think about consciousness in relation to the rest of the universe. On one extreme, you've got dualism, which Descartes very famous for, that mind and matter are separate domains and they interact somehow. Consciousness is non-physical, but somehow interacts with the physical body and brain. Not many people sign up to dualism these days, though it's still intuitively appealing because consciousness seems non-physical. Then you have idealism, that actually what exists is mind and what's hard to explain is matter. Everything is kind of mental in some way. Panpsychism says consciousness is everywhere, fundamental, well, not everywhere, but fundamental and ubiquitous. Materialism, which is the perspective that I tend towards, as you quoted from the book, is really the sort of standard scientific approach that stuff exists. We don't quite know what physical matter is. You have to ask a physicist, you know, is it strings, quarks, fields, whatever. But there is a physical world constructed of some, you know, made up of some stuff, whatever stuff is. And consciousness is a property of that stuff in some way that we still haven't quite explained. This, for me, has been very productive in many areas of science. I don't know it to be true, but that's why I said I'm a kind of pragmatic materialist. I think when you have that view, you make progress in understanding. It might turn out to be entirely wrong in the end, but if you start with a different perspective, it doesn't lead, in my experience anyway, to do the kinds of experiments or the kind of work that helps us shed even partial light on the problem. So I favor materialism because it's worked very well before. It's kind of consistent with a particular way of looking at things. We know that consciousness depends intimately on the brain. You turn the brain off, as in general anesthesia again, and consciousness goes away. Now that's a good starting point for me. It's clear, it's concrete. It may not be the whole picture, but it's a good starting point. Any explanation of consciousness should be consistent with that. Otherwise, we're talking about a different thing. Functionally agnostic bit, I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but there is another form of materialism which says that consciousness is not really a property of the stuff that the brain is made of, but of how it's functionally organized. Yeah, and then there are different flavors of that. Like some people would say the brain is a kind of computer and consciousness is a property of the kinds of computations that brains do. And that's the perspective that allows some people to think that AI might be conscious because AI systems are sorts of computers and they do computations. This is a very popular view, but I think there's very little reason to believe it. And the brains are very different from computers. So the form of materialism and functionalism that I like to explore is one that doesn't assume that the brain is a computer, that the brain is a complex system of some kind. But there are plenty of complex systems out there that are not computers. Kind of way of keeping my options open.
Predictive processing and controlled hallucination mostly describe cognition at the level of perceiving and interpreting sensory information. But if we zoomed up a level or two to the level of beliefs. What are the implications of your model of controlled hallucination when it comes to confirmation bias and belief formation?
There's a sort of smooth continuity here. You can think of belief formation as a higher level abstract form of perception. So it becomes a way of predicting what's happening at perceptual levels of encountering the world and the body. Belief can be thought of as a kind of inference. I mean, that's in fact in Bayesian reasoning, the term is there. And Bayesian beliefs are indeed probability distributions about what's going on. And you can call that a belief. In Bayes, it's a probability distribution. But maybe that's what beliefs are in the human brain and mind, probability distributions about things. And then if that's a belief, then it follows very smoothly from our perceptual processing. Now, we might, through critical thinking, update our beliefs in different ways. So, you know, we can update our beliefs through processes of explicit reasoning rather than looking at something new. There's just been this long debate in psychology about whether perception, you know, the way the world appears to us, is firewalled off from cognition, which is typically thought of as where thinking happens and belief formation happens and the other things that are a bit further from the periphery of our perception and our action in the world. So some people have maintained that, you know, cognition is firewalled off from that. So there's no direct or there's any indirect influences. But I think the more experiments are done and thinking about it some more, it's for me, it's unlikely. I think it's more likely there's some form of cognitive penetrability where there's an interchange between what we believe and what we perceive that goes in both directions.
I find it difficult to come up with an argument, and maybe there's some kind of research that I don't know about, that reasoning operates on an entirely different process than interpreting sensory information.
You want to look for differences, you'll find differences. Put people in brain scanners and ask them to reason their way through an abstract problem. You know, you'll see different parts of the brain light up than when you ask them to, you know, play a video game or passively watch a movie or something. But the fact that you can see differences does not mean that the processes are very separated. They might still be closely related. And I think it's a very important research area. It is, I confess, outside of my wheelhouse a bit. We study mainly perception, not belief formation. But there are some contexts where it becomes very relevant for me too, which is, for instance, in thinking about conditions like psychosis, which can start off as perceptual abnormalities. People have hallucinations. They perceive things that are not there. But then if the process is allowed to develop, unusual perceptions can become unusual beliefs. In psychiatry, we call them delusions. There's an etiology here where one process naturally leads to another. For me, again, suggests that there's a continuity rather than a hard separation between them.
What you're saying is that we shouldn't be too quick to jump at this particular time to the analogy of the large influence that the top-down processing that can have on interpreting the sensations coming in. We shouldn't be too quick to jump to the idea that that really explains confirmation bias.
I think it might be a useful part of that story. So confirmation bias, I suppose, is the way I'm thinking about it, and you have to tell me if you have a different idea in mind, is basically looking for evidence to confirm the beliefs you already have.
I would think of that as more motivated reasoning. I mean, I look at confirmation bias as going a step beyond that and actually ignoring or maybe not even acknowledging, not even how the evidence that disconfirms our beliefs come into our consciousness.
Right. There's a very interesting and larger story to be told, indeed to be written here, I think. I can only just hint at it now. But one of the exciting frontiers of thinking about the brain as this prediction machine and this process of prediction error minimization is that if you take these ideas very seriously, then you start to think that the brain is doing this at various different timescales. And in order to minimize sort of prediction error in the future, it might be forced to look for surprising information in the present. You have this kind of trade-off of instrumental perception where you might perceive what you are expecting to perceive, an epistemic perception where you look for new information. If I want to find my car keys, I have to move my eyes around. I have to generate new perceptual information in order to find my car keys on this hideous mess of papers on the table. This idea of confirmation bias, I think, could be modeled in quite an interesting way by looking at how the brain might make this trade-off in different ways over different timescales, when it's optimal to discover new information, to update the models that it has, or whether it's considered by the brain more useful to exploit the models it already has rather than update them. I'm not sure if it's the full story, probably not, but I find it very exciting if there's a continuity, if you can take a single general process and it can shed light on similar things happening at the level of how we perceptually experience the world. Yeah, well, we have a confirmation bias in how we experience the world around us, in the sense that if I'm not paying attention to something or expecting it, I will literally not experience it. So that's a kind of perceptual confirmation bias. So maybe there's a continuity between how that unfolds and how we are thinking about confirmation bias in this higher level belief sense of the word.
Very good. I'm right with you. I'm searching for that continuity too. Well, Professor Anil Seth, I want to thank you so much for taking your time with us to share your work and your thoughts about the nature of consciousness, and really for writing that book, Being You, A New Science of Consciousness, which has given us all access to the exciting progress being made to examine that human capability that we all take for granted, yet have very little understanding about consciousness. On our Facebook page, we're going to post a link to your personal website. That's anilseth.com, anilseth.com. And that's a kind of a one-stop webpage. There's a lot there. But are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
People can follow me on Twitter, or X as it now is, at Anil K. Seth, with a K in the middle for my middle name, or Instagram on Prof. Anil Seth. But also, the Center for Consciousness Science at the University of Sussex has a webpage too. It's too long to rattle off verbally, but if people search for consciousness science at the University of Sussex, you can find out more about what the rest of the people in my university do. Many brilliant colleagues working on fascinating problems.
Okay, we'll link to that. And a big thanks also to our listeners for your interest and support. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly. Think for yourself, people. It's your first and your last chance.